Take a Bible and open to the book of Ruth. For the most part, we'll be setting up camp here this morning and thinking about this wonderful little book. Patriarchy is a term you might hear in the news nowadays. It's going to be discussed on social media, and it's usually going to be a critique of that. I'm not getting political, but most of us know that about the biggest debate you can have right now is white and male privilege. And so this is something that is in our language right now. And simply put, patriarchy is a world in which men are the focal point. Again, this is not a critique. I'm not trying to critique the idea of patriarchy. We just need to understand what's going on with that term, because that is the background to the book of Ruth. It was a man's world. Women were defined by three different men in their lives. First, their father. You would be the lady daughter of somebody. And then you would be defined by your husband. You would be this lady, the wife of him. And then later in life, you might be defined by your typically oldest son. And you would be this lady, the mother of someone. And that's just the way it was. Women needed men in this world. To be a widow was very unfortunate, but to be barren was to be cursed. If your husband died, which typically in history he's going to, how often do we see that just in the biblical stories? But at least there's that son that can take care of you. And you're kind of always thankful for that. I find it interesting that we see Peter's mother-in-law seemingly in Peter's home. She was fortunate. At least she had a son-in-law who was going to help her and take care of her. And so again, I don't want to get into the political side of that, but we want that in the back of our minds because of where the book of Ruth opens. The book of Ruth is about two women. The book of Ruth should really be called Naomi and Ruth, to be honest. They're the two main characters. But it's such a patriarchal world that it starts with the dude whose name we can't even remember. And that's Elimelech. You couldn't even start the story with the woman who is one of the two main characters. We have to start with the man. And so that's where we want to begin this morning, as we talk about really the conversion of Ruth. Ruth, we understand, was a Moabitess, and she is going to come in not just to the people of Israel. She's going to come into the very messianic line of the people of Israel. And so we want to think about her story. We want to think about her conversion, and then we want to think about a concept, a theme that runs throughout the whole book this morning. I started with 5 points in this sermon. And I was just working and typing and writing. And by the time I got done, I had like 7 pages of notes. And I said, well, that ain't going to work. So I scrapped 2 points. You might get them later. Who knows? We'll see. But I'm not going to do like I did last week and give you 3 sermons. We'll just have one today. Let's think first about the story of Ruth. Most of us know the story, but let's review it anyway, because it's essential so that we can pick up the lessons for why this story is even here. I'll give you one reason I think why it's here is because the book of Judges ends really badly. The book of Judges ends with two of the worst chapters you could ever read in the Bible. I never will forget, I was 11 years old, about to turn 12, and my dad preached on the last two chapters of the book of Judges, and I sat there dumbfounded that those chapters could even be in the Bible. And I was just like, what? I still haven't preached on them. They're terrifying. I don't know what to, I don't know how to talk about that in a public discourse in a mixed company. The book ends so badly. And so we open up the book of Ruth, and it starts in the time of the judges. And by the end of the book, you're almost just breathing a sigh of relief. Whew, finally, something good is happening to somebody. It's about time. But let's think about this story. There was a famine in the Promised Land. And a man by the name of Elimelech had two sons. And he had a wife, and he had to care for them. And there was no food in the land. So he takes them to the land of Moab. This is just across the Jordan River. It's not that far. It would be about like us from this, from where we are, probably going to about Tennessee. That would be about the distance that we're thinking about. He just crosses over the Jordan River, gets out of the mountainous region of Israel into maybe where there might be some crops growing. And while there, his two sons marry Moabite women. Not a good start to the story. In fact, as you're reading that, you'd probably think, that's not, I mean, really the only qualification for a good wife in the Old Testament was that she be an Israelite. It shouldn't have been that hard. And yet we see with Samson, we see his troubles, and now we see this, that these two sons marry Moabite women, and that's in there because it's going to trick us a little bit. We think that might be where the drama comes from, but it's actually from this Moabite woman where the goodness comes from. And so we are deceived a little bit in this. It's good storytelling right there. Well, Elimelech dies. Wait a minute. I thought he was the main character. That's where the book opens. How does he die? Well, at least Naomi has two sons. She's so blessed that she has two sons. Then they die. This is not good. Because in the meantime, Orpah and Ruth, her daughter-in-laws, have had no children, specifically male children. And now we have an Israelite woman in a foreign country with no man to help her. Nowadays, ladies can get good jobs, they can get the education they need, they can take care of themselves. In this day and age, these women are now just waiting for it all to be over. And so Naomi is going to return to her land. She hears news that crops are growing again in Israel. So if she's going to have to be a widow and barren or without children, at least she can do so in her own land. And so she's headed back to the Promised Land, and she tells her daughters-in-law on the way, ladies, you need to go back to your homes so that maybe you can marry again and possibly have children. They were much younger. Naomi can't have more children. Obviously, she's past that time of life. And she says, at least you can do this. And the daughters-in-law, very close, obviously. They're weeping and crying. And Orpah gives her a hug and turns to leave. And Ruth says, I'm not going. I'm staying with you. We'll talk about this more in just a moment. Naomi tries to push her away, not because Naomi doesn't love her. It's because Naomi loves her. She knows what's awaiting her because Naomi has been a widow without children in a foreign land. Ruth is about to be a widow without children in a foreign land. At least go back to your father and mother's home. She says, I'm not going to do it. I'm going with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you go, I will go. And where you die, I will die. They're going to go to the Promised Land, and they're going to have to glean. And this is when you went to the fields and you could take food from the corners of the field. This was kind of their welfare program. You did not harvest the corners of your field. You also didn't go over your field a second time. I can imagine, as a farmer, not my vast plowing experience, that you tried not to leave a lot in the field. I'm imagining you went through it again to get what you could out of that field. Well, they didn't do that. They left that for the needy. And that's how they're going to have to live. They're going to barely get by on subsistence living. Well, they go close to a man who happens to be family. And they're going to glean, or Ruth is going to glean in his field. And he notices when he comes in that day that there's a new person in the field. And he asks around about her. They say, though, this is Naomi's daughter-in-law. And no doubt they had heard the horror story and the sorrow that these ladies had been through. And this man goes above and beyond. Let her glean closer and be protected. Here is a woman without a man in a field of men. It's not a great situation. Ruth is even afraid of her, Naomi is even afraid of her being assaulted. He says, no, let her come in. Protect her. Don't you dare touch her. In fact, let her glean where you're putting the sheaves together. Where they've already harvested, let her take some of that. He invites her for seemingly almost a special lunch that day. She takes all this extra food home to Naomi, and Naomi's eyes light up. You were in the field of Boaz? He's a kinsman redeemer. He has done good for us today. God has blessed us today. And Naomi gets to thinking about possibly playing matchmaker. And if you've seen the movie Fiddler on the Roof, well, you know that she's going to enjoy that. That might be a bit stereotypical, but I'm going to leave it in. And so they get a little bit excited. We have some hope. We've had sorrow. We've had nothing but sorrow. We have a little bit of hope. And she stays in Boaz's field all season, all barley harvest season. She stays in his field. He protects her. He helps her. He gives her more. And then Naomi says, they're celebrating the end of harvest tonight. Go to him. In the middle of the night as he is out on the threshing floor. And he will tell you what to do. And she goes to him, startles him. Whoa, of course it would, right? Can you imagine being asleep and out in the fields and someone pulling your shoes off and taking your cover? Hey, it's cold here. What are you doing? Who is that? And she says, it's your servant, Ruth. She says, you're our kinsman redeemer. And we're in need. He says, okay. Problem is, there's a closer kinsman redeemer. But if he won't do it, I will. He takes care of the situation the next day. Already starts off to be a good marriage. She only has to tell him what to do one time. How great is that for her? I mean, what a good promise starting to their marriage. The next day, he finds the nearest kinsman redeemer. He tells him what's going on. He says, I can't do it. And he says, good, I'll do it. And he takes care of it. And we see that he and Ruth get married. And this woman who was barren has a child. And something we'll emphasize in just a moment, it's not just any child. It happens to be the grandfather of the great King David. It's a wonderful story. Take it home, read it in about 15 minutes. It's a lovely, lovely story. We see sorrow, we see hope, we see salvation. What more could we want in a story? But what I want to think about for a few moments is Ruth's conversion. Because in this day and age, society, people did not change gods. We might think about someone going to a different church. We might think about someone even changing denominations. And that's not that big of a deal in our society. Well, in this day and age, it didn't happen. You served the God of the land in which you lived. Gods were local. The deities were local. If you were a Philistine, you served Dagon. If you were an Ammonite, you served Molech. If you were Phoenician, you served Baal. You were Egyptian, well, you served everything. If you were an Israelite in the eyes of other nations, if you were an Israelite, you served Yahweh. Ruth was a Moabite. She would have served Chemosh. Usually, you would only hear about a conversion after a defeat. If your nation was ground to a pulp by some other nation, you might then would start to serve their God. And that's what we kind of touch on with the story of Rahab. You'll remember when the spies go into Jericho and Rahab hides them. When that immediate situation is over, Rahab, talking to the spies, says, "I've heard about you. And I've heard about your God. I have seen what he has done." And our hearts melted within us, she said. She's so impressed by what God has done, she says, "I want to be part of your people." And the implication is that she wants to be a servant of Yahweh. And then with Ruth's conversion, we see the idea of complete loyalty. Look at verse 16 of Ruth chapter 1. Ruth 1 at verse 16, "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord,'" and notice that's all capitals, she calls him by his name, "may Yahweh do so and more to me, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined. Now, to be fair, Ruth's conversion is highly related to Naomi. But I don't think that should bother us too much, because I think we see that Naomi serves the true and living God. She is a part of God's people. She lives in the land that God promised to give to Abraham. I think what we just see here is the influence that Naomi and probably earlier Elimelech had on Ruth. They made an impression on her, and she wants those blessings. And what we see is that in her conversion, it's all about a total and complete change. No longer is she a Moabite. So the Old Testament law prevents interracial marrying. Now, when we think about that, we would think black and white, Mexican and white. We would think along those terms. And that's not how it was thought about under the old law. It wasn't about the color of your skin. What God forbid was marrying someone who served another god. That was the problem. Well, this Moabite woman is no longer serving another god. She has made the change totally and completely to God. She has a new direction. She's headed to the promised land. She has a new home. Might not be that much, but it's with the Lord. She has a new family. She has a new master. And we see this total and complete change from Ruth, the Moabitess, to Ruth, the Israelite, the daughter-in-law of Naomi. Now here, I think, is where the majority of our lesson will be. I need to define for you a term. I'm going to use it a lot. And I'm going to use this term a lot because we don't have a good English word for it. And the term is hesed. Technically, I think it's kesed, but I don't want to say kesed for the rest of the lesson. So we're going to say hesed. That's how most people typically say it. And it's an important, central theme in Ruth and in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, this word is used 245 times. It is used 127 times in the Psalms. Turn over with me, if you will, to Psalm 136. Here is a wonderful psalm of praise. It is called, usually referenced as, the Great Hallel. Hallel, as we just talked about in class, means praise. And this is the great praise. And you've seen this psalm before, and we've done this psalm before. We've done a few verses of this psalm. Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good, for His steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods, for His steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of lords, for His steadfast love endures forever. And it's thought by most commentators that this was a song that they would have sung back and forth, that the song leader, if you will, would have said the first part, like in verse 4, to him who alone does great wonders, and the congregation would have responded or sung back or chanted back, for His steadfast love endures forever. Notice every verse of this psalm. For His steadfast love endures forever. For His steadfast love endures forever. For His steadfast love endures forever. That term, steadfast love, is this term, hesed. And we see it in this psalm a lot, and we see it throughout the book of Ruth. The literal term is only used a few times in Ruth, but the idea is woven throughout the book. And the reason I use this term is because there's no good English word for it. I looked it up. It's translated in different ways. Love, kindness, loyalty, mercy, favor, steadfast love, and loving kindness. And most scholars, most lexicons will tell you that it's really all of those things combined. And if we're going to pare it down to something, it would be something along the idea maybe of covenant faithfulness or loyal obligation. And what we see regularly throughout the Old Testament is God's hesed, or God's steadfast loving kindness, mercy, grace, favor towards His people, because He's promised them He would be. And He is going to be faithful to that promise. And so we see this in our book, in our story of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1 at verse 20, we see that Naomi feels like God has removed His hesed from her. And in Ruth 1 at verse 20, we read, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi," which means pleasant. She says, "Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" There's a number of different things here. I wish we had more time. You remember the waters at Meribah? Where the waters were bitter. She says, "Call me bitter." She says, "I went away full." That's not true. She left because she was empty of food. She went away full of security, though, because she had a husband and two sons. And she comes back with none of that. And she feels alone and vulnerable and scared. She feels that God has removed His hesed from her. In chapter 2, at verse 20, Ruth has gone out and she's gleaned in the field of Boaz, and there's this little sparkle of hope. Maybe something good can finally happen. And she says in verse 20 of chapter 2, "May he," that is Boaz, "be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness," that is the Lord's kindness, and the word kindness there is our word hesed, "whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." So Ruth comes back and she feels like God has removed his head. Well, she is reminded that no, he has not. That he is still faithful to his people. And then we see that Boaz goes out of his way to show Ruth and Naomi this hesed. It's a couple of interesting laws here. Three specifically. The first law was this gleaning law. And I've already mentioned it, that they could glean on the corners of the field. And they could glean after that field had been harvested. They could go back, the poor, the needy, could go back through and get what they needed. Even traveling, just going by a field, you could grab some to satisfy your needs for that day. And so Boaz is already allowing the people to do that. The law commands that. But Boaz goes a step further and shows this hesed by allowing her to come in where they've already harvested. And he even says at one point, pull out some of the grain that you've already bundled and let her have it. He's making this very easy for her. He's going out of the way to make sure she and her mother-in-law has enough. And he tells her, I don't want you going back to her empty-handed. Take to her what I've provided here. And so there's one law where we see that he goes above the law. And the idea, and you've heard this phrase, and a lot of times this phrase is abused, but what we see is that he is not concerned with the letter of the law. He is going for the spirit of the law. He goes above and beyond. There's a second law that comes into the story here, and that is the leveret law. And I think you'll remember this is when a husband and wife marry and the husband dies before the wife is able to have children. The next brother is to come in and take this woman as wife, and their first son will count as the son of that first husband. That way the lineage continues. That way the land stays where it's supposed to stay. The most famous story are the sons of Judah who are supposed to do this, but don't do it faithfully. We see the second son not doing that faithfully. Boaz is not a brother. He is under no obligation to take on this wife and her mother-in-law. They come as a package deal. He's under no obligation to take her and to possibly sire a child that will bring no benefit to him, because this child will count as Elimelech's descendant. And we see him obeying not necessarily the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. He could have said, it's not my responsibility. I'm not a brother. And that probably, maybe, would have been fine. But here is a man who sees these women in need and says, I know how we can make use of this law so that you can have what you need. And then there is a third law. There is the Redeemer, the Kinsman Redeemer law. And this is where you are in financial straits. You're having trouble making ends meet, and you don't have anything else to do. You need to sell your land. And this, they didn't want to do this. This is one of God's promises to Abraham. The land was to be held in perpetuity, and there was one law that you could take advantage of. You didn't sell it. If you're from the tribe of Judah, which they were, you don't sell it to someone from Dan. You sell it to someone from the tribe of Judah, specifically a kinsman redeemer, some close kinsman who can come in, buy the land, and it stays within the family. The proceeds from the land gets you out of trouble. And depending on the kindness of the kinsman redeemer, we see what happens with the land at a later time. Boaz purchases this land to bail out Ruth and Naomi. And instead of benefiting from now owning this extra land, he is going to hold this land not in perpetuity, but he's going to hold this land to give to their first child as the descendant of Elimelech at no benefit to Boaz. Do you see what this man is willing to do for his people, for his family, for God's people? This is what this hesed looks like. Let's just put all this together here real quick. He is going to take a woman whom he is not obligated to take. He's also going to take her mother-in-law. We knew of a situation like this in Russellville. We had a dear friend whose husband had had all sorts of trouble, alcoholic, and they had gotten divorced at one point. And she kept the mother-in-law and took care of her. And when she passed, it was like she was the daughter. So he's going to take this woman that he has no obligation to and her mother-in-law. Don't forget, she's got a mother still in Moab. He's going to have two mother-in-laws. He's going to take this mother, this woman, and her mother-in-law. And he's going to try and sire a child with her that will not be his. And then he's going to buy this land to bail out this mother-in-law and then give the land to her descendant that he's going to have for her. Do you see the self-sacrificial nature of this man? So Naomi thinks about God's hesed towards her. We see Boaz's hesed towards Ruth and Naomi. And then we also see that Boaz acknowledges the hesed that Ruth shows to Naomi. In chapter 3 at verse 10. Ruth chapter 3 at verse 10. And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." He knows what she has done for Naomi. Look at chapter 4 at verse 15. Chapter 4, let's actually start in verse 14. "Then the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age.'" Listen to this. "For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." I love that picture. Here is a woman whose story begins. This is Naomi we're talking about. Whose story ends by all the men in her life, all of her protection, dying. And the story ends, "Yeah, we're really happy that this child has been born, but it's Ruth who was more than seven sons to you." I love the picture that we see here. Strange thing happens. A barren woman becomes an Israelite. She adopts the God of Israel. She adopts the people of Israel. And she marries a man of Israel. And this barren woman becomes not barren. This is the story that we read over and over and over in the Old Testament, where God blesses them. But we want to notice what happens. verse 16 of chapter 4. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." And they named him Obed. And so what we see is that, yes, Ruth is the one that gives birth to this child. Boaz, yes, is the one who sires this child. But in the lineage, this is going to count. As far as land and inheritance right, this is going to be Naomi and Elimelech's son. And we see all of these people loving, having mercy, showing grace, seeing this hesed towards one another. And it's a wonderful story. Here's a woman who's not part of God's people. She was not in a relationship with God, and things are not looking good. So what did she do? She began a relationship with God. She embraced the people of God, and by the end of the story, they embrace her. Look at chapter 4 at verse 11. Chapter 4 at verse 11, this is the men of the city. He goes to the gate to conduct the Redeemer business for the day. The elders need to see this ratified. It's kind of like us getting a notary to stamp our important documents. They went to the city gate and had the elders see what was going on. Then all the people, verse 11, who were at the gate, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who was a Moabite. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman." Do you see what happens? Even the people of the town bring this woman in. And they compare her to Leah and Rachel, the mothers of the nation of Israel. They compare her to they compare the house to the house of Judah. They bring her in as well. And then finally, we see that she is a part of the royal line. A son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez, who's the father or the son of Judah. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. It's such a cool way to do this story. It's almost like you already know the story of David. And most of us already do before we learn the story of Ruth. And then right there at the end, the author makes this connection. Why is this story so important? There's great lessons in this story, but why is it really so important? What we see here is God's hesed. Because God had promised Abraham that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. We also know the promise that God made to David, that he would always have a descendant on his throne. Well, there's a problem. There's a link that's going to be missing in this genealogy. So what does God do? He fills it with a woman from Moab. How cool is that? Especially considering that the law said a person of Moab will not enter into the congregation of the righteous, will not enter into the praise of the Lord in the temple, even up to 10 generations away. This Moabitess comes into the family of David, and 4 generations later, we're talking about her great-grandson as the great King David. And in Psalm 23... that great-grandson, King David, would write, "Surely goodness and chesed will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Surely goodness and mercy. I can't promise you royalty. I can't promise you that if you convert to the Lord and are baptized and have your sins washed away, that your great-grandson will be some great king. I can't promise you that. But the Lord does promise you another crown. And that's a crown of victory. Be faithful to me until death, and I will give you a crown of life, we read in Revelation 2 at verse 10. A crown of victory, a home with God. There's another phrase that comes up in this book, and that's the idea of rest. Naomi wants to find rest for her daughter-in-law, Ruth. And she gets it. I find it interesting that we are promised rest. Won't you have God be your God? Won't you have God's people be your people? Then be buried with Christ in baptism. Be raised to walk a new life, converted to the Lord, to serve Him in faith, obedience, and hesed. Since I'm doing the invitation song, it's always a little weird when I end a sermon and then offer the invitation and say, come now while we stand and sing. So I'm going to wait for John to pull up the